This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friend, to episode 440 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I chat with Dmitri Kokhmi. So here's where I try and talk about books news, and perhaps there is some, but I don't know about it. I also like to talk about my progress on projects as a writer to terrify myself into productivity. And this week, inspired by Chuck Palahniuk's advice about revision, and consider this, I revised a story I finished last spring, which didn't quite work then. I think it works now, and I did send it off to a magazine. Hopefully on Monday I can finish revising a flash fiction, another installment of The Confessions of Guy Psycho, so I can send it off to Jason Croft, editor of Bachelor Pad magazine, which has run four of these confessions so far. And on Thursday, a poem of mine was published by the brand new journal Autofocus, edited by Michael Wheaton. Michael had asked to look at a parcel of autobiographical poems, one in particular from a reading of mine he had attended, but he didn't go with that poem. Instead, he went with my poem called Tinnitus. We had both forgotten about how much I bitched about the tinnitus sound designs in Children of Men. Anyway, the journal features three pieces, and it is the perfect length to read in one sitting. You can check out the magazine at autofocuslit.com. The magazine is open for submissions. Last week, I spoke of the mysterious materialization of a CD called All the Best from Hawaii. Longtime listener DJ Rout suggested I don't contaminate my machinery with this hazardous contraband, but it was too late. If the CD contained a virus, it's in my main computer here at the Drunken Odyssey headquarters. But so far, I haven't noticed anything. Let's get to the interview.
And now, the interview of the day.
This is a historic occasion on The Drunken Odyssey. Dmitri Kokhmi featured an essay on a show in June of 2015 on Paul Bowles' Sheltering Sky, and he has been a blogger for The Drunken Odyssey with The Pensive Prowler, and he is now the typist for a madman known as the Sawzold Scribbler, currently appearing occasionally over at thedrunkenodyssey.com. He's the author of the autobiographical novel Motherland, which is a deeply charming and memorable book, And he's also the author of the brand new book, The Door and Other Uncanny Tales. And this is the first time we've been speaking in real time, despite having a working relationship for 5 years. So, Dimitri, it's great to talk to you and congrats on the new book.
Thank you very much, John. It's so nice to see you and to hear your voice, finally.
In the interest of full disclosure, I blurbed the book.
You blurbed.
And The Door and Other Uncanny Tales, what you're doing is you're basically telling classic horror stories without it seeming old-fashioned. And yet, if I'm looking at, okay, what is he doing to the horror genre? It seems like just telling good stories. Like, I don't know that there is a wild strategy towards telling ghost stories other than making them good, which would point at probably a pretty important idea, which is maybe horror doesn't need reinventing if you take the material seriously.
Exactly. That's exactly. I'm glad you picked that up, actually, because I do not differentiate between writing, let's call it a literary novel or fiction, mainstream fiction, and genre writing at all. For me, I treat it in terms of story, character, let's put across a good story. I certainly make absolutely no attempt to reinvent the genre or to reinvigorate it in any way. I think I say in the introduction to the book, the only effort I put into anything when I write is really to tell a damn good tale. I want to create a finely wrought tale that seduces the reader and traps them in my head for half an hour or an hour, or however long it takes to read something. So really, that's really the only approach I take when I write.
It's a respect for the genre that, I guess because it's so easy to find bad examples of the genre, that it may seem disreputable, but that's not the fault of the genre necessarily, although it may be the fault of readers who will put up with too much.
Well, this reminds me of, as you know, I was an editor at Penguin Books for 15 years. What you just said reminds me of a conversation we had at Penguin Books with various editors. When I was an editor there, other editors would come to me with genre manuscripts, science fiction, fantasy, horror, etc. And they'd say, Dimitri, can you read this? Because I do not know how to read genre. They go, what do you mean? What do you mean you don't know how to read? You are an editor. The only criteria with genre material is you read for story. You read for character. Is it a damn good story? Does the manuscript work? There is no other criteria, at least not for me. Possibly other genre writers may have a different take on that, but certainly not for me. The ultimate thing for me is respect for the genre because really, I mean, as I'm sure you know, some of the greatest writers have practiced, have written in this genre. You know, Henry James's The Turn of the Screw, Edith Wharton's amazing ghost stories, E. Nesbitt, Patrick McGrath. Do you know Patrick McGrath's work at all?
I do not.
Well, he's an English writer who writes in the gothic mode, as I like to say, but he lives in New York. Half the year he's in New York and half the time he's in London. He's an incredible writer. But you would read Patrick McGrath and you go, this is literary writing of the highest standard, but it's gothic.
You should be able to just read a horror novel and figure out if you like it or not. And I guess if you're not familiar with the genre, the secondary question is this original enough? Or like, how does this stand out? If you're not familiar with the genre, that's like a secondary question.
Yeah.
It seems unfair to just pass it along. Like, I can't do anything with this. Like, really?
I think, you know, really it comes down to the individual writer and their particular sensibility. Very possibly, the only difference the stories in The Door and Other Uncanny Tales, the only difference there is that they are Dimitri Karpny's sensibility. And what do I mean by that? I think, as you know, I was born on a small island in Turkey in the northern Aegean Sea. I'm Greek, but I was born in Turkey. So my background is Greek Orthodox Christianity, but I grew up in a Muslim country. I'm influenced by the West, particularly Greek mythology, but the culture in which I grew up is Middle Eastern fable and mythology, particularly the Arabian Nights. And of course, I have lived in Australia now for almost 50 years. So this is really my home. So no doubt, without me even really being aware of it, the stories in this collection are informed by the confluence of three cultures. I don't know if that comes through in the stories. I'm so close to it, I don't really see it.
It's not one of those loud facts the way it is, say, in Motherland. But also, like you and I have had conversations where sometimes you're just perplexed by something that happens in America or some attitude or some social concern we have. And you're like, what is wrong with you guys? And conversationally, what I would tell you is, you know, Dimitri, you're not normal. And like, that's a good thing, but you're not normal.
What do you mean? How dare you? Well, you know, I grew up within the genre. You know, I don't know if I've told you this story, but I saw my first horror movie when I was 9 years old in Turkey. I didn't know it at the time, of course, but I was watching George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, dubbed into Turkish. I thought it was a Turkish movie. And it was only perhaps a decade or more later when I came to Australia and I saw it on Australian television. I thought, oh, that was an American movie. I had no idea. So I've been immersed in the genre pretty much since I was 8 years old, 9 years old. And Australian television in the 70s and 80s was replete with horror movies, with American television series such as Night Stalker, Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been percolating away in the brain for a long time.
Well, Night of the Living Dead, I think, is a pretty good primer for just understanding America.
Certainly what's going on at the moment.
Well, but what's going on at the moment has been slowly building, I think, for 50 years or more. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I say you're not normal, like, here's the thing. I'm not normal, but I know I'm not normal.
Oh.
And in fact, I think one of the reasons why I gravitate towards more or less a preppy look is because it really confuses people when it turns out like, oh, but I don't really think like a preppy.
Okay, you see, this is really interesting to hear you say this, because one of the things, I don't do very many things consciously when I write. Initially, for the first couple of drafts, perhaps, it's very, very instinctive. And it's only from the third draft on that planning and forethought kicks in. But one of the things that I do deliberately when I'm writing is this. I try to hide the horror inside a beautiful package. So the writing for me, right from the very start of the process, is always what I consider to be beautiful writing in terms of the syntax, the sentence structure, the flow of a sentence is very, very important, because I guess what I'm trying to do, I do this with Motherland as well, is I'm trying to sugarcoat the ugliness that's burbling under the surface. And I know it's there with Motherland because a lot of people, such as yourself, often say it's such a charming book. But it's actually a very ugly book as well, because there's a lot of violence and ugliness. I mean, an entire ethnic group is being cleansed out underneath that beautiful prose and those beautiful images I'm creating. And I think the same goes for The Door, the main novella in this book. It was very deliberately crafted to sound like a modern version of a Henry James short story. In fact, I even used Henry James's The Jolly Corner as a leaping off point.
Yeah, a little bit less ponderous than James, but it's in terms of the psychological niceness of it. I don't mean kindness necessarily, but just very finical, very exact, which makes it really alarming when the corners don't come together.
They don't come together, exactly.
And so The Door is a story about a painter who paints a door, and then complications ensue when his boyfriend goes on a trip and he's kind of left alone to contemplate this trompe l'oeil door that he has conceptualized in one way, but it starts to complicate his sense of reality.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I see that story very much as a metaphor. My partner Lee read it recently and he was totally creeped out by it. And he said, "This is what's in your head all the time?" Went, "Yeah, pretty much, yeah." But for me, the story works as a metaphor. You know, Lee, I think my partner Lee took it as a literal representation of a man confronting his doppelganger. But for me, it works on a purely metaphoric level where the door, the painting of the door, acts first as a mirror for the self. And then he opens the door and enters the space within, therefore entering his own subconscious in order to examine past mishaps. So for me, the story works on a whole other level. So when I listen to people talk about it, I go, "That's funny. It's not how I see the story at all."
Ultimately, it comes down to who the hell are we? And how much do we really know about who we are? And if you actually, here's a challenge, guys. Just look in the mirror for 7 minutes straight. And then not be insane by the time you're done with 7 minutes. Like, put the timer on.
Exactly.
And you're like, and if you're somehow superficial enough, you may do fine. But otherwise, you're just like, who's doing this to me? Why? What's happening? Just, it is like the scariness of existing is a real problem. And ultimately, as writers, it's something that we are trying to solve without driving ourselves too crazy. And maybe kind of points you a little bit more directly into that direction.
I think horror, you know, is really the perfect genre to explore exactly what you just talked about, because in terms of how I see the genre, it's a very internalized genre. When it's done properly, whether it's in film or in literature, all the tropes, all the metaphors of the genre work to push you further and further inwards, not outwards. And I think the best novels, the best films in the genre are all about the private psychology of characters. I'm thinking specifically of, do you know the 1961 film called The Innocents with Deborah Carr?
No.
It's based on Henry James's The Turn of the Screw. But the script is written by Truman Capote.
Really?
Okay. So it's the Turn of the Screw story, but Capote reinvigorates what for me is a sluggish, terribly unreadable story. And it's a marvelous instance of a film that improves on the novel. It is a sublime story, but deeply disturbing too, because not only is it exploring a governess's repressed sexuality, but it goes into very dangerous territory of child sexuality.
Yep.
So it's actually really worth chasing up the film and watching it. It's filmed in sublime black and white. And the deeper you go into the story, the deeper you go into the Deborah Carr character, into her own psyche. And you begin to see a woman disintegrating before your eyes. It's a sublime performance that influenced Nicole Kidman's performance in The Others. If you see the two films, they're almost mirror images of each other. So I guess what I'm trying to say is when I write, I'm often influenced by that kind of horror movie. I don't really go for zombie flicks and vampire flicks. They bore the crap out of me. But I do love the ghost story for some reason, which I can't quite figure out why exactly. So, in fact, most of the stories in the book are ghost stories.
Yeah. They're so varied that it's not like, this is just themed variation. Like, they all feel really different. And sometimes it's not until, like, we're more than halfway through where we're like, now it's a horror story.
Are you thinking of The Long, Lonely Road?
I am, yeah. And You know, thinking about horror and what it allows us to do, it kind of makes sense to me that when Naked Lunch was filmed, that it kind of required a horror director to really get a hold of the material and the potential for the material, so that it was David Cronenberg who could sit with that material. And I think David Cronenberg's movies are really uneven, but even the worst one still has some really interesting things in them. But still, I think Naked Lunch is a masterpiece. And I think a director who, you know, did straight drama, I think probably would have struggled intensely with the strange metaphors and the very sense of, you know, what does it mean to be a human being? Or what does it mean to be William S. Burroughs, which is still a human being, but yeah, definitely a unique, very unique human being. So yeah, when I say you're not normal, like basically none of us are normal. There is no normal.
I would have to agree with that. I would have to agree with that. I think, you know, a lot of the not normal, for me at any rate, as a gay man too, I think comes from the very fact that as a gay individual moving in society, you often have to adopt various masks and various guises as you go through your day in order to protect yourself. So you become a master of disguise. And you become a master at slipping in and out of various characters and characterizations, depending on what situation you find yourself in. That, for me, is exacerbated by the fact that when we lived in Turkey, for instance, I was Greek in the house. I was Turkish in the street. I spoke Greek at home. I spoke Turkish in the street. We came to Australia. I spoke Greek at home. English in the street. In the home, my name was Dimitri. In the street, my name was Jim, because apparently, thank you for laughing. I can't see myself as a Jim, because apparently Australians couldn't pronounce Dimitri until there was a sufficient number of, you know, ethnic people in the country to sway the balance. So you know, you become a kind of chameleon, a social chameleon that flows in and out of character. And this is why, you know, Cronenberg's films appealed to me right from the word go from the 70s. I remember the body horror films that he made with, you know, the body as malleable as plastic, in which things can thrive inside the body, but also the body can deteriorate and disintegrate and become something else, as in The Fly, for instance, and as in The Naked Lunch. So you become adapted to that. And I think if I bring anything new to the genre, I think it is precisely that. Dimitri is basically a schizophrenic.
Or that identity is largely performative, that, okay, Jim, and I'm sure your behavior changes because everyone is calling you Jim. Partly, I think of that Monty Python sketch where the philosophy department, everyone was named Bruce.
That's right.
And they go, Michael Baldwin, Bruce, Michael Baldwin, meet Bruce, Michael Baldwin, Bruce. And they're like, is your name not Bruce? No. And they're like, well, can we call you Bruce? But when they call you Jim, even if it's just a, you know, like a momentary thought, like I imagine your behavior is like, well, what if I am a Jim? All right. They expect me to be Jim. Like, what would Jim do? And are those things Dimitri wouldn't do? I don't know, but they might be things Dimitri wouldn't have thought to do, which kind of these performative aspects of our character in public, right? If you're a son, if you're part of a couple, if you're a teacher, if you're a podcaster, you know, all of these different identities we wear, they may actually be pretty different from one another. And I used to be a lot more energetic and funny. And I guess it kind of follows the Bill Murray trajectory where, you know, he used to be this zany clown and now he's this deadpan person.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm as funny as Bill Murray, but what I am saying is I kind of have this deadpan, like my voice doesn't, you know, have this huge range of inflection. It's more like...
You do have a very distinct voice.
This kind of baritone that, you know, it sounds great, but it doesn't, you know, it's not great acting. Let's put it that way. And so all of these different things go into who we are. And I think as writers, it's really helpful for us to be aware of that and maybe to remind other people of that. And it could actually mean the whole difference between us actually not being who we think we are at all much of the time.
And, you know, this is This is something that particularly intrigues me in fiction, this whole notion of reality and perception really, really fascinates me. I think I explore that to some degree in the stories In the Door, but I've just finished a novel called The Woman in the Well, which is with a publishing house at the moment. And it's really all about that. It's all about what is personality? Who am I? Who do I think I am? As opposed to how do people perceive me? What creates personality? What is memory and what is truth? All of these things, I think, again, you know, I think they're really perfect subject matter for the genre. I really do. I think the genre, in a way, was, who was it that said the horror genre is actually a very subversive genre? Mm-hmm. People tend to think of it as very conservative. It can certainly be conservative because I think the tropes within the genre and the expectations are very conservative and limited. But really, when we examine the horror genre as it evolves from, let's say, you know, from Mary Shelley, but it started earlier than that, of course, it came out of Romanticism. It was a reaction against Romanticism, mm-hmm. the positivity and the love and the light of Romanticism. There were the cynical goths sitting there going, yeah, well, it's a lot darker than that. And here are the stories. So you have stories like Frankenstein, which is really the Promethean myth, in a way, man stealing fire from the gods. Then you have amazing stories like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which if you read the novel, not the films, but the novel, it's a remarkably subversive novel, possibly one of my favorite genre novels. And then, of course, you have Dracula, which digs deep under Victorian sexuality. So the genre is actually very, very subversive.
Well, I think the conservative frame lets all of that subversion in because the guilty will be punished and because traditional morality will normally be upheld as at least the goal. You know, Russ Meyer's films always ended supporting whatever mainstream culture said the ending needed to be. After he's shown rape and drugs and, you know, knife fights and gun and, you know, car races and whether the women are naked or not, absolute pornography. And I say that not as a criticism, but he always made sure that there was the standard justice at the end so that when people would complain to him, he would go, no, look at the story, which is a little bit absurd and, you know, willful on his part. But I think that's kind of the way horror works, right? That's why the teenagers having sex, those are the first people to die, usually, you know, in the slasher film. And that's how you're allowed to show nudity and sex in a horror film while also punishing that behavior. So it's a little bit like the Carnival and Twelfth Night. It's like, okay, everyone's going to be married to different sex partners, but we have a lot of things to explore before we get there.
I think John Waters' films, you know, are also horror movies. I think of them as horror movies, but horror movies for the middle class, because basically his films, his early films, not the later films, are reactions against 1950s American middle class and all the freaks and monsters that populate those movies are really the finger to American middle class. But really, when you examine those movies, I mean, Divine is a monster. Mm-hmm. Didn't he say Divine is Jane Mansfield crossed with Godzilla? Isn't that great? I love that.
Yeah. A deliberately ugly drag queen.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Which then becomes its own kind of mad beauty. I have so much admiration for filmmakers who keep me awake. Cronenberg and John Waters. It's like, hello, all right. Like, it's hard to be bored watching their movies.
Brian De Palma and David Lynch are the other two.
Yeah, I think I might want to argue about Brian De Palma, although if we choose a playlist, like, there are certain De Palma films where it's like, okay, no, like, I completely buy into that. So can we talk a little bit about the style of Motherland? Because the first half, it's more than half, right? But there are two sections of the book. One about your childhood. Three sections?
Part one, part two, and part three. Part three goes back to part one.
Your childhood is depicted in what I would call these Proustian segments. And what I mean by that is long paragraphs, and each paragraph is like its own little section or like a mini chapter. And, you know, the paragraphs are long like Proust, although unlike Proust, you do care about your reader. So, you know, one of the things we do when we see a long passage is, okay, I'm not sure how long I have. Let me see how long this paragraph is. And Proust, it's like 8 pages. I'm like, really, Marcel? Really? And so for you, like 2 pages is like as long as you expect us to sit with any particular section. And it just, it's a novelization. It's not strictly autobiography or memoir.
Fictionalized, yes.
Which basically lets you, well, it keeps you from lying about how well you remember things while making them incredibly vivid.
John, what I'd like to say about the chosen style of Motherland is it was very deliberate. I think it was into the third draft when I found the voice for the boy, which dominates part two of the book. I'd been writing for about 2 years and I just was not hitting the mark. It didn't feel right for me. And when I finally got it, I'll tell you a little story about that. I was asleep and in the middle of the night, I woke up. It was 2:30 in the morning. There was a voice running through my mind. I knew it was a little boy's voice speaking very, very rapidly and describing a scene where he's sitting under a mulberry tree with his mother and his sister. And I woke up, scribbled it down on a notepad I keep for those purposes beside my bed. And in the morning, I typed it up and I knew I'd found the voice for the book. And now the reason the sections are paragraphs, not chapters, is when you listen to a young child speak, they speak very, very rapidly, don't they? It's like, ah, and with no heed for anything else except what they see and perceive. So I wanted to capture that in one paragraph block rather than chapters. But for me, always, always, the reader is paramount. You have to keep the reader in the text. You cannot lose them. So they had to be very short at the most. I think the 2 pages is the longest, but even that for me is too long.
Well, one thing I find is, yeah, I get crankier and more restrictive with myself the older I get. Like, okay, yeah. So that I, you know, looking at Guy Psycho, I'm like, okay, no, all right, that sentence needed to be cut in half. And all right, this is why that adjective, like fewer adjectives, come on.
As a writer, John, though, as a writer yourself, don't you find yourself sometimes going, you know what? This needs to be the way it needs to be. Stuff the reader. They can do the work. I find myself getting a bit sort of antsy sometimes. You know, I think, well, this paragraph needs to be 2 or 3 pages long because that is how the story flows within the certain context of the narrative. Now, actually, I'll give you an example. This happened with one of the stories in the book. The story is called Light in Her Eyes. It's the second last story. Now, when it was first written, there's a dream fantasy sequence in the second part of that story, and it was 3 or 4 pages long. It was all one paragraph. It just flowed. I did it like that because it's a dream sequence in which we are trapped inside the character's head, and I wanted to capture the reader and hold the reader in that. But my editor, who's a marvelous, she's a very talented novelist as well, just went, seriously, no. You're going to lose your reader. And I had to listen to that, so we broke it up into several shorter paragraphs, much to my chagrin.
Well, I feel like I've gotten so much of my literary yayas out with a novel that's currently like on my shelf. So it's something I started years before Guy Psycho, and any crazy literary prank I wanted to put, like, it's in there. And Guy right. Psycho is also very, very playful. So I do feel like less youthful, I think, about no, I have to try, like, okay, you don't have to. I think I trust I can bring enough playful light to whatever it is that I'm writing that's like, no, I'm way more concerned about how quickly this could be read, like how quickly this could be processed. And I know it will be challenging enough without me adding my thumb to the scale going, okay, and then try this out.
I'm afraid I'm not a minimalist. I was listening to your interview with Chuck Palahniuk yesterday, and he used the word minimalism several times, and it made me think about my own writing. And I don't think I'm a minimalist. I think I'm very much in the tradition of English writers of the 1940s and 50s, where there's a kind of density to the prose. At the same time, though, as an editor myself, I know that I have to make it easy for the reader. So hopefully I strike a balance between the two.
Well, there's always this cost-benefit analysis, and this is something that David Foster Wallace focused on a lot, especially when editing Infinite Jest. And if you ask me, he could have taken out more. Like, he could have.
Yes.
But there are hundreds of pages that didn't go into that book because he was making decisions about when to challenge his readers and how much to challenge them. And so, yeah, I think that's something that we do need to consider, like, as literary writers, too. Like, we have what we want to accomplish with style. And, like, I do argue, right, style is meaning. That's
Exactly.
And maximalism, like, isn't wrong.
Maximalism? I don't know this. I don't know this term.
Well, just think of Wallace and how, like, okay, he'll have a footnote that'll go on for five pages. And it's like, okay, like, most novels don't have footnotes. And so to have a footnote that's going to chase a foul ball five pages.
Yes.
Like, that's clearly, if minimalism is telling the leanest possible story and then creating it like poetry so that, you know, the emotions are going to surprise us and kind of pop out, maybe independently of like a traditional story. Maximalism, you know, is kind of going in the other direction. And again, it kind of submerges the idea of a normal story.
There's a remarkable novel, American novel, came out perhaps 20 years ago now, called The House of Leaves. Do you know it?
I have not read it, but I am familiar. Yeah, I know of it.
I can't remember the author's name, unfortunately. But it's a horror novel, and it's maximalist. There are so many footnotes, and the footnotes go on for so long. They create an entire narrative of their own as you're reading. And I have to say, I've tried to read it twice now, and I've never finished because I just give up.
Mark Z. Danielewski?
That's him, yes. I've never been able to finish it because I feel myself, as a reader, I'm being pulled in two or three different directions with concurrent stories being told. And it's too demanding for me. And I never want to make it that demanding for the reader. Because ultimately, I think people read as diversion. I think they read for entertainment and enjoyment and pleasure, not to be stressed out and to be tested in any sort of way. That's what I loved so much about Guy Psycho, you know. I screamed laughing for most of that because it was like watching an old Warner Brothers cartoon. It was so funny, and it was so easy to zip through it.
Well, my goal is I want book two to be even easier. And so now, on the other hand, there are books that are so vapid that they're so easy to absorb that it's like eating Jell-O that's gone bad. You know, so I think it was Lipstick Jungle, Candace Bushnell of Sex and the City fame. Like, I thought Sex and the City was an okay show. I read like 50 pages of this novel, and it took, I don't know, like 25 minutes. And I'm like, there's nothing here. Like, I'm reading, and it doesn't feel like a reading experience. And so there's like too easy.
Your brain's going on a slide, and it's downward slide.
Something like that. Yeah. And so, you know, when I read Infinite Jest, I was in my 20s, and, you know, that's when I read Gravity's Rainbow. It's when I was reading Ulysses and writing a master's thesis on Ulysses. And so as a difficult young man in his 20s, like, all of those difficult books were perfect for me. A little prisons that I could be dropped into so I will be less harmful to other people. And I'm not sure how much patience I have now for that kind of a doorstop of a breathtakingly difficult book. I might do just fine, or I might not.
I have to say, much to my embarrassment, I don't have much patience. I've tried over the years, I've tried Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Ulysses. I have a marvelous edition of Ulysses sitting up there staring at me, going, read me. I'm going, I can't do it. I just can't. I don't have the patience for it.
I haven't read Finnegan's Wake.
You haven't? Well, I've got that up there as well. And yet, you know, I can easily read Shirley Jackson or Susan Hill. I can read three or four of their novels in a month.
I feel really strongly that, like, it's my job to keep getting slicker. I can't see myself writing a story that will be so easy to absorb that, like, it'll be a problem. I think no matter what I write, it's going to be strange enough and challenging enough, you know, without the prose getting in the way.
This may be all a very cultural thing, you know, John, because I think you remember about 3 years ago, I did a writer's residency in Croatia.
Yeah.
I met a marvelous, talented Serbian writer called Zoltan Danjil when I was there. He and I, of course, were showing each other our writing, respective writings, and the people who ran the residency were novelists as well. Interesting novelist, because it's a husband and wife team and they write together. He writes one chapter, she writes the other. They send and transfer, and they use one name only. So it's only one author. Now, I was looking at their work, the Europeans, at least these particular Europeans, it was very dense, very thick writing, huge, long paragraphs. Forget a paragraph was just one line. Forget a sentence that was nice and short and precise. Sentences would go on and on. I questioned this. I said, you know, this would be a nightmare for an Australian editor. I would want to cut down everything to nice and short paragraphs, precise sentences. And I said, in Europe, Germany, etc., they're much more dense text. And I think it's cultural.
It may have something to do with how much time we plan to spend reading. If I have 20 minutes, all right, what am I going to do with Finnegan's Wake? Right. If I have an hour and a half, you know, and I can do that every other day, then that time may be fruitful. And, you know, the frustrations of reading the book could become part of the pleasure. Whereas with 20 minutes, it's like, okay, you might as well just hit yourself in the head with the book and then call it a day. But I'm thinking about this in terms of the long section of Motherland and how it does force the reader to slow down. And, you know, it's kind of like every little segment fades out and then fades into the next one. And it works kind of the way a man might think as he's earnestly remembering what it was like to be a child. And the book is masterful at that. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why I feel compelled to call it charming. It's not because this lad has it easy or that the place where he lives is charming necessarily. No, the place where he lives is completely fraught, and he doesn't understand all of the dangers that the members of his family put each other into, and then the culture where he lives and the moment in history that they're in and the political problems he's likely to face. He's becoming slightly aware of all of that. But he's in love with the girl next door, and he's trying to figure out how can he be cool with his friends when his friends are starting to act like assholes. And he loves his mother, but it's very difficult to actually just be calm in a place with his mother and experience that love. Like, there's, in part, it's the style, and it does force the reader to slow down. Like, this isn't a book you can burn through. It's more a companionable book that, you know, you want to keep reading. But the way that it's written, and I feel like for all of my impulse to say, you know, we need to write books to be page turners, and like everything you do has to contribute to that end. Like, I think that's relative.
I think it's relative. I think it's relative too. I think each writer, you know, has to find their own place in, let's call it the industry for want of a better word. You know, again, I was listening to your interview with Chuck Palahniuk yesterday. You were talking about putting a book out every 2 years or something like that. Well, it's been 10 years since Motherland came out. And, you know, I'm in no hurry to put out books. I want each book to be as good as I can make it. But more specifically to the conversation, I think the book will find its own audience. I don't rely on building a readership and expecting them to come along. Here's the next Dmitri Kakmi book, I will buy it. Very likely, people who read Motherland will not read The Door because it's a specific audience for that book. I have no illusions, but more than that, I don't expect to build an audience, and I don't expect readers to follow me from one book to the next. I expect to build a new readership with each book, because I want each book to be completely different from the previous book.
Knowing you the way I do, yeah, it does seem like, oh, there's a different Dimitri. Like, it took me a while into Motherland to go, oh, he's not telling any jokes.
No, it's such an earnest book, isn't it?
it reminds me slightly of Angela's Ashes, and it reminds me a little bit of Joyce, a little bit of Proust, but mostly I'm imagining young Dimitri, and it's such an extraordinary reading experience, but it also, yeah, it didn't line up with the blogger who wrote for me. And the smartass on Facebook, you know, which is, I think that's how I invited you, right, to blog for me, is I'm like, you're a wonderful smartass. Can you be a smartass for the Drunken Odyssey? And for a while,
I think the Dimitri Kark me in the door is closer to the blogger and social media Dimitri, I think.
We contain multitudes. At least that's what Walt Whitman said.
What does William Peter Blatty say? Legion. I am legion.
Yeah. Can you talk about writing Motherland? And all right, I see how you claim it's three sections. I was treating the first part like it was a prologue. Yeah. So it has these segments from 2002, and then there's the childhood bits. Yes. And it's one of those wonderful reading experiences where I will never forget it. Partly it's the craziness of youth. And I think that's so difficult to accomplish, actually, is what did it feel like to be a kid? And I think most people probably can't do that. Virginia Woolf did it, I think, at the beginning of To the Lighthouse, when the little boy, his father says something smart, and the little boy's like, I want him dead. That's what I knew. I love you, Virginia Woolf. Like, we're going to be friends for the rest of my life. This book of yours really accomplishes that while having to cover a lot of history and geography that your readers probably aren't that familiar with. So can you talk a little bit about the genesis of this book?
The genesis really for Motherland was my first ever return to Turkey. We left in 1971, and I didn't go back again until 1999. I was almost 40 by that stage. I remember wandering around the island as an adult and having this welter of emotion and memory coming back to me. But the thing that really stood out was I realized very quickly that the Greeks of Anatolia were a dying race. When we lived there, there were perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 Greeks on the island. When I went back, there were 32 elderly Greek people. And I think now there's about 2 or 3 left. When I realized that these people are going to die and the stories of the Greeks of Anatolia who had been there for thousands of years will disappear with these people. And I felt duty bound, I suppose, to write the story of these people before it vanishes altogether and there is no memory left. So my intentions were very, very honorable and terribly, terribly earnest. And I came back to Australia and I started writing almost immediately. But it was basically a history book. It was this dry facts and figures. Even I was bored with it.
A little too earnest.
Too earnest, too dry. You think, who's going to read this? And it was really only when I came across the boy's voice, when I found the voice, and then I was researching, I was doing all manner of interviews and what have you. My sister rang me up one day and she said, are you still writing the bloody book of yours? I said, yes, I am. And she said, well, come over for dinner. I have a story to tell you. And she told me my mother's story, which is all in the book, the whole lot of the secret life of the mother that I had no prior knowledge. And I thought, oh, I need to integrate the mother's story in this. This is a very human and archetypal story that needs to be in the book. So I started incorporating the mother's story. And then my father rings me up and says, are you still writing that book? I said, yes, I am. And he said, come over. I've got something to tell you. And he told me the story of Athena. You know, Athena is the girl who lives next door, who disappears. And the little boy is very much in love with her. They told me the story, her story. I thought, oh my God, this is earth-shattering. I have to incorporate her story. So in fact, the book went from being this dry historical artifact to being the story of two women, the lives of two women as seen through the eyes of a little boy who is caught between them. That's when the story began to kick in for me as a writer. Prior to that, I was interested only as an observer of facts and figures, then became human, and the writer Dimitri kicked in and took over. I was going to say it liberated me as a writer to then begin to experiment with form, structure, voice, tone, and so on.
That's the way it is with books, where you wait until you have enough pieces, and then you're like, all right, this is alive now.
Yes, yes. You know, that happened with The Door. I can't remember if you and I have talked about this, but The Door came about because I saw that painting in a friend's house. He painted it, and I was having dinner there that night, and the painting was hanging in the stairwell, and it immediately fired my imagination, but I didn't know what to do with the story. A year later, he emailed me a detail of the painting, and it was the doorknob with a reflection of the painter himself painting the painting. And it was all I needed. But the minute I saw the doorknob with his reflection, I knew I had a story that is about a painter who is reflecting about himself.
So we have all of these fragments, and we're just kind of waiting for all the pieces that we need.
I'm sure you find the same thing with your writing. You know, you have disparate pieces all over the place, and then one thing begins to link them all together.
Well, right now I'm frustrated because, I'm waiting for that to happen. I've got two books I could write, and it's like I've got one piece, and I know I need at least two more, and come on. Oh, no.
John, it's been more than 18 months since your first book came out.
We're around 18 months, yeah.
Yeah, you're losing leadership.
I am, and it's actually something I am really thinking about.
Really, do you worry about that?
I do. It's one thing if I don't know what I want to do next, you know, like I don't want to put something out there just to put something out there.
Absolutely.
But I, you know, like I, there are things I want to do, like I can't fully see them yet, but I know that they're there. Like I've got over... I think I have over 40 Guy Psycho titles. I have no idea what they're about, but I've got 40 different cockamamie Indiana Jones style titles for these books, and I don't know what they're about, but I'm trying to get that second one going, and then I actually have a horror novel that I'm puzzling about, and I should have the pieces because it's based on something, but I have to adapt it in a certain way where it's going to feel like my adaptation is going to be worthwhile. And so I feel like I don't have a grip on that yet.
Mm.
So yeah, it's, I guess it's like fishing, and I'm not a good fisherman. I'm like, God damn it. Jump in the pail. Like I got things to do. I
don't know about you, John, but I find that if I feel like that about a project, rather than sit around waiting for things to come, I sit in front of the computer at 9 o'clock in the morning and I begin to write until 12:30 in the afternoon or 1 o'clock. And most of it is shit. Most of it will be deleted the next day. But somewhere in that pile of shit will be one or two sentences that chime. And you take them out and you go, okay, I can sit down tomorrow and connect these sentences to other sentences. So I actually force myself, rather than sitting around waiting, I force myself to do it.
Well, I'm not really waiting. I don't have much time, which is why, you know, like I am trying to make sure that whatever bits end up in my head, like, okay, make sure those get written down. Don't work twice as hard to get the thing that just popped in your head. Just make sure you get it down. But I need a couple hours a week to read completely separate from the podcast. Just, all right, let's explore new ideas. Let's explore history I don't know. And then I need hours with either a whiteboard or just paper and just go, all right, whatever. Like, let's mess around a bit. But I haven't really been doing that. So I've got some shorter things I've actually been hammering out and revising and trying to get them as exciting as I can. Well, this is turning into a therapy session for me.
All right, John. I'm fine with that. I'm a good listener.
So, I agree with you. Like, if that's something you could do, I'm trying to calm my life down to where I can, yeah, spend some of that time that I need to, the quiet time to just, as I call it, sit with a mystery and let things happen.
I don't know about you, you know, but I've actually found the Melbourne COVID-19 lockdown, in which we have been now since May, has been extremely good for writing. There's nothing else to do. You don't need to be anywhere else. You don't need to see anyone. Therefore, you can sit at the computer and suddenly 4.5 hours have gone by and you've been working pretty solidly. And I can do that for, let's say, 5 or 6 days a week. And also, unlike you, I just write now. I don't edit anymore. I don't work for Penguin Books anymore. I don't work as a freelance editor anymore. So I actually have nothing else to do other than to write, which is so marvelous. I can't begin to tell you.
Sounds great. Yeah, no, partly because I do this podcast, it's kind of like whatever time I might have, it's like, okay, there it goes.
Wow.
And so it pressures me to get writing done so that I'm not simply talking about writing, but getting some done. But on the other hand, it's also reducing the amount of time I have to write in. But I think that ultimately it's about play, even if what we're writing about is very serious. And so partly what you're talking about, just having the wide open time, is really important in terms of being able to play. And yes, that's when I feel like I actually am a writer, like I could be writing something decent. But if I don't get to that place where my mind is like, you know what, I'm not going anywhere until Wednesday. I don't have to go out and get more food. All right. So it's like, okay, I've got to deal with my students for 4 or 5 hours, and I'm going to read for an hour. I'm going to go take a walk, go for a swim, and spend some hours on my writing. And I feel so incredibly civilized on those days. And yeah, like the pandemic has actually made some of those days happen. And I just need to try and make more of those days happen.
The other thing I find really helps with writing is diversity in what you do. Example, I'm writing another novel now. It's a very dark crime novel with a really sick character. So I'm really caught up with this really sick bastard's brain. But at the same time, I'm putting out the Sozzled Scribbler columns for you, which are completely different.
Oh, you mean you're typing them?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, yes, we are typing. Oh, my God. I'm typing them. And, you know, that piece of writing is so completely different to anything that I would normally do. It is liberating a part of the brain that I think I rarely ever use. And it's actually teaching me a great deal about dialogue, mm-hmm. which I've always struggled with. But because it's so dialogue-driven, that column, that I'm learning a great deal about dialogue. But what I'm saying is I think as writers, perhaps it's worth having 2 or 3 quite different pieces going on at the same time, a novel, an essay, a short story, whatever. And shifting free between these modes may actually untangle a lot of things in the brain, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yeah. So the Sozzled Scribbler is an alcoholic aristocrat who has strong opinions and may not be the most responsible world citizen.
He thinks of himself as being a very responsible individual and he's here to save the planet. Do you know he actually turns 200 years old next year? He's 200. I asked him the other day, how do you manage it? And he said, from the age of 17 onward, he's only been drinking gin and smoking Gauloises cigarettes. That's all. He doesn't eat. And it preserves him. So I highly recommend gin and cigarette full time, nothing else.
I think the diversity of projects, especially if you're working on something serious, having something way less serious, which nevertheless carries with it certain demands of excellence and show business value.
Absolutely. I think Mr. Sozzle takes his column very seriously, even though it's a piss take in a way. In Australia, we say piss take. I don't know how you would say that in America. He takes it very seriously in terms of writing. The writing has to be. So if I say to him, that's good enough, he says, no, it's not good enough. We have to improve it.
Well, I also note that sometimes you write more of those or you type more of those than you had anticipated because he keeps speaking to you.
he keeps speaking. It's, you know, he was here this morning, but he's just stepped out. So unfortunately, you can't meet him today.
But well, as his editor, he's not always pleased with me. So
I know he has a very, very dark view of you. He's not impressed. But I think, you know, he hides behind that because he often says, "What do you think John thinks of this?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. He's never told me. I have no idea." So actually, you know, that's a good question for you. You know, you receive these missives from Australia twice a month. What the hell do you think of that demented individual? Because he really is. I mean, he's unhinged.
Well, he's wrong, but he's wrong in ways that are always interesting.
He will be furious to hear that you said he's wrong. There will be a lot of stomping around in the corridor.
Which is why it's a privilege to have his column. And I do feel like I learn, maybe things I don't necessarily want to learn, but I learn with every column that he produces.
You know, we are working on a novel at the moment. He wants it to be like Dante's, oh my God, I just forgot Dante's book. What's it called? Divine Comedy. He wants it to be structured like the Divine Comedy. So he's very demanding in terms of what he wants.
I presume then the novel will begin in America.
I think so, my friend. I think so.
So one thing I was really impressed by in Motherland is the sense that Greek mythology wasn't dead.
No, it was not. This is what's so fascinating about growing up in a place like that. Even though we were Greek Orthodox and Islam was the dominant religion in the region, Greek myth was very much alive. It was not unusual for us, people to come from the country and go, "I passed such and such grove and I heard the god Pan playing his pipes at midday," or your uncle will come back and he'll say, "The nymphs were dancing around a particular well or spring." No one laughed at them. No one said, "Don't be ridiculous. That's fantasy." Didn't. Everyone was very serious. Or people would tell you that a genie, had come to them in a dream and told them that there was treasure in a particular place in the hill. And we took all of that very, very seriously. But I find that fascinating because, again, I think it fed into my fascination with genre writing. I think, really, I couldn't have gone any other way. For me, it was reality. And as you probably see in Motherland, the little boy talks to the ghost of his dead grandfather. Well, of course, he's dead. He's got his ghost. But the ghost of his grandfather is basically his teacher. That's real, you know. That wasn't made up.
Mm-hmm.
That part of the book is not fiction. Everyone presumes that it is, but it's not. So, yes, Greek mythology, the supernatural, were very much alive in those cultures. That's why, you know, I wasn't surprised when we came to Australia in 71 and very, very slowly I realized there was an indigenous population here who are predominantly very much in touch with nature, the natural world, the connection to soil and place is very, very strong, as was ours in Turkey. But more importantly, the Australian Indigenous people are animists. Therefore, conversations with ancestral spirits are as real as you and I talking right now. You don't question that. So I've always felt much more connected to Australia's Indigenous population than I did to Australia's Anglo-Saxon population, from whom I was rather alienated.
And possibly still are.
Largely, yes. We have our battles. We have our battles, let us say. And every now and then we call truce and raise a white flag.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Dimitri Cockmey and Scribophile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including those diaries of Asal's old scribbler, spoken of in this episode, as well as Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth, and The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. All right, gang, until next time, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life, is a supernova, an interstellar jamboree of colors and lights, like the twirling dresses of a troupe of champion folk dancers, like being imprisoned inside Ace Frehley's amp, throbbing like the veins in Jehovah's hard-on. You can look, but you can't touch, and also you can't look, because if you do, you will turn to stone, and your guts will turn to marble.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.
Never mind, John. Pass me the bottle.